Hello, everybody. Madeline, and it's been really fun to be here hanging out with everybody for the last few weeks. So today I'm going to talk to you about some work that we did recently together with Jacques, who some of you guys met the first week of the course and the program. He's a postdoc in the lab. And what I'm going to show you is some work that I think leads to some open questions about how you can generate regulatory novelty in development. So I guess I wanted to start by saying that, or at least by reflecting on a lot of things that I learned throughout these last few weeks. And the color isn't quite right, but I guess it's okay. Oh well, it's okay. Anyway, so we talked a lot about how protein coding sequences evolve throughout these last few weeks. And basically, what that leads to is that proteins now can evolve new function or new properties in general. But we haven't been talking too much about the processes leading to the expression of these proteins. Basically, when, where, and how are these proteins expressed? So basically, these processes are dictated, or this expression is dictated by transcription factors, by activators and repressors that bind in the vicinity of the gene and dictate this level of gene expression, again, of the proteins. And these regulatory regions are also subject to mutation, are also subject, in principle, to natural selection and therefore to evolution. And there are many documented examples of regulatory regions where evolution has led to some binding sites being lost, or even new binding sites being adopted for a completely new transcription factor that wasn't there before. All right? So over the last few years, I've been fascinated by many examples of how evolution is tuning what I would call these regulatory knobs in gene regulatory regions. And what I mean by these knobs is basically how many binding sites for a given transcription factor do you have? What's their placement? What's their affinity? And there are many examples of how, by tuning these knobs, evolutionary novelty can arise. And for example, one of my favorite ones comes from Sean Carroll's lab, where they found that a certain regulatory element picked up two new binding sites for transcription factors, and that led to a whole new pattern of pigmentation in the fly wing. Okay? But also, it's another aspect of this type of tuning of knobs that I find fascinating is that despite large rearrangements in regulatory sequence, sometimes you end up having the same pattern of gene expression. So that's exemplified here, where I'm showing you three different embryos of three different species, all stained for the same gene that is expressed in seven stripes. And what you can see below are the regulatory regions dictating the expression of the second stripe of each one of these embryos. And If you can tell, you know, here, for example, in Cetoscura, these binding sites disappeared. There's a new binding site. Some of the sites moved around. Some of them changed in affinity. And despite all these changes in the regulatory regions, you basically get the same phenotype every time. Right? And finally, there's another aspect of how you can generate regulatory novelty that I find also pretty thought-provoking, which is, now, instead of going around and tuning details about the regulatory region, what if you steal the regulatory region from another gene? All right, so this would be enhancer co-option or regulatory region co-option. And one way to think about it is maybe that you have your enhancer that is preferably talking to this gene on the left, but all of a sudden maybe some mutations can arise that change the affinity of that enhancer for this promoter and now switch it to talking to this second promoter. And in that way, in one fell swoop, you can actually gain a whole new regulatory pattern of expression for this promoter on the right. Okay, and this is, I don't think this has been completely proven, that the examples of this have been shown, but for sure there are some cases that suggest that this could be one strategy that evolution employs to create novelty. And so the talk today is going to be focused on these mechanisms, on exploring the mechanisms that determine the specificity and the interactions between enhancers and promoters. But so what we're going to do is basically a molecular exploration of the processes underlying how enhancers decide who to talk to, which promoter to talk to, and how multiple enhancers also compete with each other for the real estate of the promoter. And what we'll try to do is use this, what we're going to learn here, to speculate a little bit about the role of these enhancer-promoter interactions as a substrate for evolutionary novelty. All right, so the talk is going to be divided in three very short parts. And so I'm going to give you a quick introduction to fly development, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And then I'm going to talk about some technology that we had to develop to actually enable this this program, or to be able to ask this question, to quantify how enhancers actually, how often do they interact with promoters, for example. And finally, we're going to look at the role of redundant enhancers in the context of fruit fly development. And we're going to speculate about the role on generating the novelty. OK, so, and please feel free to stop me anytime. I'm very happy to skip things, and we don't need to get all the way to the end. So, but for those that don't think much about flies every day, so just let me give you a very quick introduction to what flies do. Basically, one of their main roles in life is to lay eggs, like this little guy here. So this is about 0.5 millimeter in length. Okay, so here you're catching a female fly right in the action of laying an egg. This egg at this point has been fertilized and has one little nucleus. And that nucleus goes through multiple rounds of division. The first job of this embryo is to make many, many, many nuclei. And by 3 hours into the development, you got on the order of 6,000 nuclei surrounding the whole embryo. At this point, these nuclei start moving around. You got cells, and they start creating patterns, creating segments. Okay, so this is going to determine the segmented body plan of the fly, and some of these segments are going to later on go on to become legs, wings, etc. And but one thing that I find interesting, and we're not going to talk much about it, but I still thought I would mention it, is that the role of making the segments and of specifying their identity seems to be decoupled. So there's another set of genes, once you generate the segments, that assigns identity to each one of them. And it's relatively easy to switch the identity of one segment for another one. For example, you can convert this little structure here called an altir into another wing very easily. Okay, this is one, for example, the ultrabithorax mutant that some of you might have heard of. Now, development is wonderfully dynamic. Like, this all takes place in 3 hours. And so these static pictures don't make that much justice to the wonderfully dynamical nature of development. So let me show you what this looks in real time. What you can see here is an embryo, again, 0.5 millimeter in length. And this embryo has been engineered such that each one of these nuclei is fluorescent. And what we do is we just look at the nuclei as we come to the surface and go through these multiple rounds of division. And even though, you know, all these nuclei look the same, right? You couldn't tell this nucleus from this one. So even though they all look the same, they've already started talking to each other and deciding what they're going to be when they grow up. And those decisions are going to be manifested now by these massive rearrangements called gastrulation, where you can see the separation between the head and the thorax of the embryo. And you can move even further in time with now fancier techniques. So this is with a confocal or two-fold microscopy. This is using a light sheet microscope. And you can look even later in development at more complex morphology, at the creation of more complex morphological structures. And if you can, you might be able to notice already the different segments here. You can see the periodic pattern here. It's going to become clear in just 1 minute. And this is in hours. Okay, so this is all happening. This here happens in the first 3 hours of development, and then by 1 day, you got a new larva. So here you can see these segments already, okay, by 10 hours into the development of the fruit fly. Okay, so as I said, all these nuclei here look the same, but they already have unique identities. And the way they decide on their identities is through the implementation of a gene regulatory network that is wired in a sort of cascade. And I would like to argue that this cascade is probably the equivalent of the hydrogen atom for developmental biology, because we understand it so well. What I mean by that is that we know that there are genes that are initially deposited by the mother that are expressed in shallow gradients. And they have funny names like caudal, bicoid, and annus. The names don't really matter. But the point is that these genes mediate the expression of genes expressed in broad domains. And all these genes now together mediate the expression of genes expressed in 7 stripes, and all of these guys mediate the expression of genes expressed in 14 stripes. And these 14 stripes are basically what sets the body plan for the embryo. These guys are setting up the segmented body plan of the fly. Yes? Well, at least for this anterior posterior patterning, for sure bicoid is being degraded right around the time of gastrulation. Bicoid is disappearing, and I don't know exactly what happens to caudal and nanos.
But I guess what I'm asking is that, like, so, like, you know, like here, this sets up some, like, kind of coordinate system on the embryo.
Yeah.
And then, like, but hypothetically, a cell were to leave its place in the coordinate system later on and go somewhere else, it would remember where it had come from, and that's how that visual entity, which kind of new location which we're seeing around it, isn't the thing which is telling it.
So in fact, there are outer regulatory modules that come on to keep the expression of certain genes on. So like even skip, for example, first you get the 7 stripes, but once you initiate that pattern, there's a positive feedback module that now fixes the cells that were on in the on state. So yeah, there is some memory there. They're not constantly reading out the information laid out by these patterns. Does that answer your question? Yeah. All right. So again, I think it's amazing that people have worked this hard and they've been able to identify basically all the important genes in this regulatory cascade. And we don't only know the names, we also know their connections. Okay, so people have, over the last 30 years, people have mapped all these connections. And sure, you might have some complaints, like, you know, how can the same transcription factor as an activator and a repressor, right? So there are some limitations to this type of description. In particular, if I gave you this network and I didn't tell you what the names are, you would have a hard time telling me that a fly is going to come out of it. Okay? Yes. So the picture is that B-coid, for example, is changing in space. And in some sense, the strength of this arrow is determined by where you are along the anterior-posterior axis of the embryo. The more B-coid you have, the more activation of Hunchback you'll get.
Okay. And these are basically fixed over time? Or do they change?
Well, they do. In principle, they do change. It's just that this type of description fails at really conveying that information, right? So you don't have any information about space, time, or concentrations in here. Okay, so it's a useful representation, but it's clearly insufficient for some of the questions that you might want to ask.
This is
lots of genetics data and lots of experiments. This is like 30 years or 40 years of work all put together in one slide. So it's just amazing. Yes, Boris. The party line for why B-coid and Krupel, B-coid can activate and repress Krupel is that it's a concentration-dependent effect. But honestly, I would claim that nobody has done the right experiment to really test this. Okay? Because, you know, you delete something here, but everything else changes, right? So sometimes it's hard to identify what's in cis and what's in trans. So I think this is one of the great mysteries, and it shows up a few times, like Hunchback Krupel, right? So, you know, for sure you can do better with this annotation, but. It's basically experiments where you start deleting or overexpressing different patterns. I don't remember exactly which one this was from, but it's basically deleting or overexpressing and seeing how the different boundaries move around. That's the type of experiments that people do. And sometimes some of these come from also recreating part of this network in single cells, in S2 cells. All right. Okay. So. Again, this is amazing. It's an amazing place to start if you want to ask questions about how developmental programs are implemented. Yes, Doctor?
This is probably a stupid question, but it seems there are some arrows where you get both activation and increasing one and repressing one at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of my complaints about our current state of the art, the fact that we can't even tell what these arrows are. Right, and in principle, part of this talk today is about uncovering the molecular mechanisms behind each one of these arrows. Yeah. Okay, so. Yes.
So these are, if I understand, these aren't supposed to represent like a molecular what's happening. These are supposed to represent kind of gene knockdown experiments and the results of those. So is that
for the most part, for some of these, we do have a much better molecular understanding of what's going on. Like this one, we understand relatively well. And in fact, today is going to be about this one and this one. Yes. But for the most part, these are genetic knockdowns or knockouts, and then looking at staining embryos. And we're going to talk about that in a second. Okay. So, but basically, how do you identify the regulatory DNA regions that are mediating each one of these arrows? Okay, how do you do that? And the classic way to do it is you grab a big piece of DNA, you put it in front of a reporter, and you see if it drives the pattern that you want. Let's say I'm looking for Hunchback, right? So I grabbed some piece of DNA that is in front of the hunchback gene, and I put it in front of a reporter, and I asked, does it look like the hunchback pattern? And then I start cutting the piece of DNA down until I find the minimal region that tells me which part of DNA, that tells me where the regulatory region is. Okay, that's how most of the regulatory regions have been found in this network. And in general, this is promoter, you know, enhancer bashing or whatever you want to call it, but it's a really laborious process. And basically the result is that the moment you find your regulatory region, you stop. Because you're done and you want to move on. Okay? So what people found is that, for example, hunchback is driven by an enhancer that is really close to the promoter. Basically, it's just a few hundred base pairs away from the start of the gene. But recently, people started looking in more detail at data on ChIP-seq, for example, and they realized that there were other regions that kind of looked like enhancers that were not that much farther away from the gene. So for example, they found a distal enhancer that by itself can drive a very similar pattern to the hunchback proximal one. Yes? For now, let's just call it a stretch of DNA where you have a bunch of transcription factors binding.
Okay.
But it is true that somehow this guy has to talk to the promoter over there, right?
Okay.
So it will have to loop the DNA, or it will have to get closer in 3D configuration.
So you mean either
of those? Well, both.
In the long range.
Well, you need to get to the promoter, but also you need transcription factors bound to that enhancer so that it can act on the promoter. So I would claim there are both necessary parts of the process. Yeah? So again, enhancers then are just collections of binding sites for activators and repressors, and those basically by looping or by some mechanism that brings them closer in physical space, that's how those activators and repressors talk to the transcriptional machinery that is waiting at the promoter. Okay? And the promoter is this little arrow here called P2 here. Okay? All right. So this is not just a freak of nature in the sense that it's not just that you find it for hunchback. Wherever you look, you keep finding more and more additional enhancers, distal enhancers. People call them shadow enhancers, although there is no reason to say that this one is the primary and this one is the secondary. You can call them sibling enhancers. The words don't matter, but you can look at KNURPS, for example. Another one of these genes are expressed in broad domains. And you find exactly the same, a proximal and a distal enhancer. And you can do it also for all the genes that are important for determining the dorsoventral program or segmentation of the fly. And this, the multiple enhancers talking to the same gene seems to be more the rule than the exception throughout development. Yes?
Is the rule a proximal enhancer and one distal enhancer, or is that just the sort of pattern along the fly, but
it's
sort of free-for-all?
It's a free-for-all, basically. It's just that typically we found the proximal ones first because they were closer. And that's where you started looking first. But yeah, no, in some cases, there are equally distant. Yes?
So can the distant
Yeah, that's exactly what this talk is about. And these stains here are for constructs where you have deleted the proximal enhancer. And these ones are for constructs where you don't have the distal enhancer. Yes, so individually, they seem to drive the same pattern of gene expression. And part of the question is, if they drive the same pattern of gene expression, why do you want them?
And those
you can show, in some cases, yeah, we'll talk about that. But if you delete them and try to do a rescue, in some cases, they do fine. And in some cases, they don't do that well. And it depends.
It's not the same thing to recapitulate the expression pattern or to have correct biological
function. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it hasn't been shown in all of them, but in SNELL, for example, you do need it so that ventral furrow invagination occurs well. Yeah. So you do need it such that you do need the two enhancers for SNELL so that you can get the right furrows appear and the right folds of the tissue to appear. Well, let's finish this one then. For SNELL, I think you do need both. So either one, you know, in the case of SNELL, they don't seem to be redundant in this particular case. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Tom?
And these are both the whole story in terms of the enhancers. If you take them both out, then the expression level is much, much less.
Yeah, in principle, if you get rid of these two, you don't get more expression. But it's also, you know, that's for these particular guys. It doesn't, there don't need to be only two overlapping enhancers. Yes, although because of how you do the experiment, usually you restrict your search to like 20 kb. So if you want to go longer, you need to now use some other technologies. So it could be that there are things more distal, although it's hard. In flies, you know, you can't go much farther than a few kilobases in terms of interactions. Yes? Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Jeff.
So what happens when you start sliding the enhancers around?
No, I don't think, nobody has done that experiment. That's a great question. I would love to do that. Mike, sorry.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I mean, can you rule out the alternative use of these in some other aspect of the wise development, other than early development?
No, although, hold on. I think both, at least in this case, I think both of them are only used in the early embryo. Yeah, although Hunchback has a role later on, and it has a different enhancer for its role later on in development. But again, I don't know if people have looked at this in super detail. Okay, all right, so, I mean, you know, this is, again, touching on Cassandra's question, on Mike's question. You know, why do you want multiple enhancers? And one hypothesis that people have been throwing out there is that maybe this is the equivalent to thinking to the thinking that you do when you think of a gene duplication event. Maybe what you do is you duplicate your enhancer, and now one of them is free to evolve a new function. In this case, it wouldn't be redundant anymore, or at least at some final point. Another alternative is, yes, Sarita.
So if you have two enhancers, even though spatially you see that it can express, multiple enhancers can express the same gene, does that make any difference in time scale?
That's what this talk is about. So yeah, just hold on with me for a few minutes, and then that's exactly what we're going to try to analyze. Yes. So, you know, one possible explanation is that this allows you to generate novelty by creating a new enhancer sequence that now you can tune at will. Another possibility is that these guys are not really that redundant. That, for example, both of them suck independently at making a pattern, and that you need their combined activities to get the whole pattern of gene expression. Okay, and obviously you could also have some combination of the two. But regardless, I think that these shadow enhancers or sibling enhancers can be an interesting case study for the process of promoter-enhancer interactions. How do multiple enhancers talk to the same promoter? How do they decide who to talk to? How do they fight it out? Okay, so that's what this talk is going to be about how these shadow enhancers work together to dictate patterns of gene expression. And in order to do that, what we need is what we're going to start with is a very simple theoretical model of how an enhancer works. Yes, Dan?
Are the shadow enhancers, do they tend to be related to the, or do the two enhancers tend to be evolutionary related to each other, or are they just related?
My understanding is that they are, and there were some reports that one of the shadows is mutating at a faster rate, but it's kind of wishy-washy. I don't think people have looked at this in extreme detail. But that would be interesting if they're evolving at different speeds. Yes?
How far that question has been explored over what evolutionary distances? So my understanding is that for Drosophila, that is certainly the case that these shadow enhancers. But when we've tried to look over broader regions, I think when people have tried to look, say, outside of Drosophila, even closer to the flies, they disappear completely.
Oh, really? I see.
Consistent with your fairly, in some cases, fairly extreme nucleotide composition shifts.
Okay.
So I think that poses sort of a challenge to think about how the evolution of this sort of pattern.
Absolutely. No, I agree. Yeah, and I don't think this question has been addressed much in terms of these enhancers. Basically, at this point, I think we're more in the data gathering stage and trying to figure out how they are different, you know, functionally. In some sense, this is about this. At this point, we're thinking about the cell biology of these enhancers. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's a great question. Yeah. All right, so how are we going to think about the action of enhancers? And we're going to propose a very, very simple model. And the point is the following. We have our promoter in front of a gene and our enhancer that is, in principle, far away. Okay, but it could also be close. It doesn't really matter. But let's assume a molecular picture, although I don't want to commit to the picture of looping that we were just discussing, but let's assume a molecular picture of binding of transcription factors to the enhancer and looping onto the promoter. Now the promoter and the enhancer are engaged. Okay, and you got a rate of on and off, right? So rate of looping, rate of unlooping. When the enhancer and the promoter are engaged, now you can start transcribing at a constant rate R. What this means is that at a rate R, you will load RNA polymerase onto the gene. These RNA polymerase move down the gene, and they will start producing nascent mRNA. Okay, this mRNA then will go on to become cytoplasmic mRNA and to become protein. Well, it's just that this engagement could be some other switch-like step. It doesn't have to be looping. So in principle, we're going to assume the same type of model, even if they're really close. Okay? And we got evidence that suggests that promoters are switching on and off in discrete steps. So, you know, regardless of how you identify this, there seems to be an on and off step.
Well, that seems like on and off are going to depend a lot on the constellation of transcription factors.
Yes, and for sure the geometry of this and the intervening sequence. Absolutely, absolutely. And we don't know how to think about it yet. Yes, but what I would say is that you can think of how these are going to be modulated in space and time because the transcription factors are being modulated in space and time. Shelley.
I just wonder if the word engagement there you don't know.
I just don't want to. Basically, I'm trying to avoid any commitment to a particular molecular picture by talking about engagement, you know, because you can talk about looping, but then it's not always clear that it's looping because sometimes these enhancers are really close. I think it's a little bit of both. I'm trying to avoid thinking about it, at least for now, just trying to find the simplest model. Yeah. Okay, so in this very, very simple model, if you run the numbers or the equations, what you end up deriving is that the rate of messenger RNA production is proportional to the fraction of time the enhancer spends in the engaged state, right? So this is the fraction, the rate of turning on, the rate and the sum of the two rates. This gives you a fraction of time of the promoter being engaged by the enhancer times some rate of initiation. Okay? So the types of predictions our models make are related to the rate of mRNA production that is coming out of this gene. So what happens when you add another enhancer? And now we need to start making commitments about what the competition between or the interactions between the two enhancers is going to look like. So on the one hand, you can have enhancer A and B. Enhancer A can engage with the promoter and produce mRNA at a constant rate, let's say. And now what we're going to assume is that only one enhancer can talk to the promoter at a time. If enhancer A is engaged, enhancer B cannot touch the promoter. But then if enhancer A is not engaged, enhancer B can engage the promoter and produce RNA at a different rate. Presumably. I mean, these two rates could be the same, but in principle, they could all be different. Okay? So the main assumption of the model is that only one enhancer can talk to the promoter at a time. All right, so now let's explore the consequences of this model and these assumptions. And we're going to make an even more simplifying assumption, which is we're going to say that all the looping rates are the same, or the engagement rates are the same. Okay? So this is just for I choose to illustrate the point, and these conclusions are actually general, but this makes life a lot easier. And when you run the math, what you end up getting is that the rate of production of the system having the two enhancers is equal to the rate of production of the system when it only has one enhancer, plus the rate of the system when it only has the other enhancer, times some factor. And this is a quantity that we're going to keep referring to constantly throughout the talk. Basically, it's the sum. It's the whole more or less than the sum of the parts, right? The whole is the rate of initiation or the rate of transcription of the system with the two enhancers, and we're going to compare it to the rate of transcription of only having one enhancer plus the rate of transcription of only having the other enhancer, okay? And you can see this factor here that determines basically that scales the sum of these two individual enhancer activities. And we can think of two regimes. One regime is the regime of very low likelihood of looping. Basically, the rate of looping is much smaller than the rate of unlooping. In this case, this factor is 1, and what you get is that the rate of production of the two enhancers is the same as the sum of the activities of the individual enhancers. Okay, so the whole is just the sum of the parts. That's what you get here. And the way to understand this qualitatively is that it's very unlikely for one enhancer to touch the promoter. So it's very unlikely for enhancer B to try to get to the promoter when enhancer A is already there. Okay? But now if you go to the other extreme and you got a very strong looping, so the rate of looping is much larger than the rate of unlooping, now they start interfering with each other because enhancer B is going to want to loop, but enhancer A is already going to be there, so it's not going to be able to get there. And in this case, this factor is smaller than 1. And you know, in this extreme case with all the rates the same, you basically get the average. Okay? So you get subadditivity in some sense. Cassandra?
And these are predictions you're making, right?
These are predictions.
What we think is
exactly. And we're going to test those predictions. Yes. All right? Questions? OK, so what we're predicting is like the range of behaviors we can observe. We can observe an additive behavior and a subadditive behavior, where the whole is less than the sum of the parts. OK. But. There could be some variance. Yes, yes. And for now, we're going to be exploring only the consequences of this model in terms of the mean levels of gene expression. And there is an alternative story that you can tell that I'm still trying to figure out how to tell it, which has to do with the variability from cell to cell. And that's actually where some of the advantages of the shadow enhancers might come in. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, but for now, we're going to focus on mean levels of gene expression. OK, but if you look at the whole theoretical, well, very quick theoretical derivation I showed you here, every time the quantity that is being predicted is the rate of mRNA production. So if you want to test these models, you need to have access to the rate of mRNA production. Okay? And this is so. And in order to do this, we had to develop new technology. And the reason for it is that the state of the art didn't allow you to measure rates of mRNA production. So basically, how do people usually study these patterns of gene expression? Well, for example, let's say you want to study one of these 7 stripes. This is a little plate where your flies lay their eggs. So each one of these little white dots is an embryo. And I apologize for those that in the course that have seen this already too many times, probably. But the point is that you collect all these eggs. And these eggs are not synchronized necessarily. They were laid at different time points, right? So they have different time points there. And what you do is you kill them and you stain them using antibodies against the gene of interest. And now you have a progression between embryos, but this is basically, each embryo corresponds to a different time point. And you can use some morphological cues to try to time order them and make, in some sense, a fake movie, right? So this is a movie where I'm morphing through different images of dead embryos in each frame, okay? But if I want to measure a rate of gene expression, I need to be able to measure how much mRNA is being produced in each cell. And here I'm killing my embryo in my first time point, so I don't get my second time point to calculate a rate at least, okay? So what we had to do first is develop technology that allowed us to go beyond these morphing through pictures of dead embryos and to actually reveal regulatory decisions in the fly in real time at the single cell level. So in the next 2 slides, I'm going to introduce you to the technology we developed to actually watch these decisions in real time. Okay? And the way this works is as follows. What we did is we borrowed technology from single cells. And what we want to see, what we want to do is count how many polymerases are moving down the gene. So what we do is we modify the fly genome so that the gene now has a little sequence that encodes for a loop when transcribed. This loop is recognized by an mRNA binding protein that is bound to GFP. And the result is that in each nucleus in your embryo, you're going to get a little spot of fluorescence. And the fluorescence of that spot is going to be proportional to how many of these polymerases are moving down the gene at each time point. Okay. So this is what it looks like when you put it all together. This is for hunchback, so you're going to see a pattern of expression like this. So in red, you see the DNA, and in green, you see the messenger RNA signal. And you see how there's more green here than here. And what you can do is you can go in and ask what's the fluorescence of each dot, which is basically the transcriptional activity. So you can plot the single-cell transcriptional activity as a function of time. And what you see is that the transcriptional activity is modulated in time in these bursts of transcription corresponding to each one of these division cycles. And it's also modulated in space, because blue is to the left of the boundary, where you have a lot of green, and red is to the right of the boundary, where you don't have that much green. Okay? So with this tool, we can actually quantify rates of transcription in real time. And so one of the things that you might complain about is that, let me take a step back, actually. What I want here is the rate of initiation, right? But what I'm reporting in this other in this other slide that I showed you, whoops, let's do this, is the fluorescence in arbitrary units, okay? So one extra step that this doesn't accomplish all the way is to report, actually count how many polymerases are moving down the gene. Now in absolute units, not in relative units that are related to how much laser power I had that day, for example. So what we can do is actually, there you go, leverage the technology of killing embryos, which isn't, you know, I've been talking smack about it, but it's not that bad, actually. You can actually kill an embryo and stain each one of its of the mRNA molecules inside of it. So each one of these dots here corresponds to one mRNA molecule. You can count how many mRNA molecules are there in the whole embryo, and you can use this information to calibrate this fluorescence in arbitrary units into a number of mRNA molecules being made, or into a number of polymerases that are actively transcribing. And you can start asking questions such as, do these numbers make sense? For example, what does it mean to have 50 or 60 or 70 polymerases on a gene? It means that one polymerase is, basically polymerases are spaced every 150 base pairs, 120 base pairs, which is basically the speed limit, because that's the size of the polymerase. If you were going any faster, they would be on top of each other. So this gene seems to be going at the speed limit of transcription. Yes? Because this is dead, and the mRNAs are not diffusing around.
Okay, so it's just about it's not moving anymore.
It's not moving anymore, exactly. That's the main trick. I mean, there are other things that make it nicer, which is you use dyes that are better than GFP and things like that. But yeah, basically, it's not moving anymore. It's not going anywhere. Yes?
What's the stability of this association? Are you counting mRNAs, or are you counting polymerases?
We're counting mRNAs attached to polymerases. Yeah, so the point is that when the polymerase falls off the gene, we stop seeing the mRNA. So when it falls off the gene, the mRNA starts diffusing around. Now it starts moving really quickly, and we can't see it anymore. The reason we can see these spots of fluorescence is because they're tethered to the DNA.
So your probe remains associated with the mRNA, but you don't see the fluorescence rate because of its diffusion.
Exactly. Yeah. And it might also get degraded quickly. So that's the other thing that we're still trying to figure out. Well, it's just that we're using it as a reporter of transcriptional initiation right now. So we don't need to worry about the degradation that occurs later on. So I'm confident in it as a reporter of initiation. And as a reporter of what's going on down the line, I think we need to get a better sense of what's going on in terms of degradation. You got a question? Yeah. Well, the nuclei are actually on the same plane, but the spots sometimes are not, so what we do is 3D segmentation. But in the early embryo, it's a syncytium, and all the nuclei are on the surface. So that's the wonderful feature about the embryo, the early embryo of the fly, that the imaging is really easy. Okay. All right, so we have this technology to measure RNA dynamics. And I didn't show you, we have some other examples, but basically every time we try to use this technology to measure something that had been measured before, we get the same answer, okay? So in some sense, what I'm saying is that we're relatively confident that it's a good reporter of the process of transcription. So now let me show you how we use this technology to try to make progress towards answering, you know, what is the role of these redundant enhancers? Do you want to add something? Ah, okay. All right, so again, the point is that the predictions are related to how does the activity of the two enhancer system relate to the individual activities of each enhancer when they're all by themselves. So the way we decided to test this is by doing the experiment that I think already some of you suggested, which is you compare the expression of the wild type of the enhancer when you have both enhancers to the expression of flies that either have one of the enhancers deleted or the other enhancer deleted. Okay, and again, we're going to ask whether how does this activity compare to the activities of these other constructs? So this is a movie of the wild type of Hunchback. So what you see is basically this pattern here, this domain here. You see there's some ectopic activity as well. You're also going to see this. The wild-type hunchback also regulates a little domain back here. There you go. And then as it turns off, this is right before gastrulation, you start getting a turning off and a little stripe here that lasts for a little bit longer, and then it's off. And then you get gastrulation, okay? Which should take place in a few minutes. Okay, so what we can do then is we can compare the expression of this wild-type gene with the two enhancers to the expression of a reporter construct that either has the shadow enhancer deleted or the primary enhancer deleted. Okay, I'm going to show you the three movies. I didn't do such good of a job at synchronizing them, so they're going to be a little bit out of sync. But I think it's good enough to see what's going on here.
What about the background or shadow case? Just different conditions that
are
there or something?
I think it's just a brightness and contrast adjustment. Yeah. I mean, when we quantify these movies, we actually take care of the background. But it could also be different flies will deposit slightly different amounts of MCP. But we know that that doesn't change the quantitative nature. Yes? That just, you know, the t equals 0 when I started imaging is not the same. And I just...
They're synchronous,
but... They're synchronous, yes, they are relatively synchronous. Their divisions last the same amount of time. It's just that the frame rate in one is a little bit different and things like that. So I could do a much better job at synchronizing them. That's all I'm saying. But it's just, yeah, and here I had to... Yeah, I made the movie in the wrong way, and then I had to swap it afterwards. But anyway, it happens. All right, so... Already here, let me replay this. Already here, you can see that these enhancers are not redundant, right? Look at the no primary compared to the two other ones, right? See, this guy only gives you, in this cycle, only gives you the stripe. Okay? So for sure, these guys are not redundant. But we can go beyond this qualitative observation. And what we can do is take a snapshot, let's say 10 minutes into cycle 13. This is the cycle before you get gastrulation, before you get these massive rearrangements of cells. And we can plot the number of RNA polymerase molecules transcribing the gene at this time point as a function of the position along the axis of the embryo. And what I'm showing you here is the level, the number of polymerases as a function of position for the construct where we deleted the shadow enhancer. And sure enough, at this stage of development, we do get the same pattern qualitatively that we would expect from the wild-type hunchback. Okay, we get a little domain. You can do the same for the construct where you delete the primary enhancer. And there is a quantitative difference, but qualitatively, they kind of look the same.
So I have a question, though, because if you look through the left-hand side of your primary, there's not any fluorescence over here.
Yeah.
Another one there was.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that cycle, we're not showing that cycle right now. And that's because there's another enhancer that has to do with later decisions that is turning on. So we're looking at cycle 13, which is... It's this one. So this is the cycle we're looking at. Okay? But yeah, it gets really interesting. And actually, it doesn't, the conclusions don't change that much. It's just easier to explain in this case. All right, so now our model predicts that the action of the combined enhancers, so the two enhancers together, is either going to be the sum of the individual activities or less. Okay? So there's an upper bound from our model, which is the sum of the activities of each individual enhancer. Okay?
Why can't lower bound go all the way down to their mean?
You could do that as well. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we could do that. It's just got kind of messy. But actually, I should have done that. That's a good question. Yeah? Yeah, there is nothing like that. Yeah, that's the assumption in the model. And actually, the reason I don't show the average is that it will be the average only in a particular case of the parameters. It can actually go really low. It can go much lower. So for a choice of parameters, you can actually kill the whole thing. Yeah, so this is true regardless of the choice of, this upper bound is true regardless of the choice of parameters. It's a consequence of saying that only one enhancer can talk to the promoter at a time. Okay? So now we can measure the wild type, and this is what we get. So what we get is, as we come from the posterior, the wild type enhancer does follow additivity, pretty much. And then when you get to high levels, it kind of saturates, and now it's subadditive. Okay? And obviously, this is only one snapshot. It's also fun to look at it as a function of time. We can repeat this plot for each time point in the movies that I showed you before, where now I did a better job at synchronizing them. And what you see is how throughout the whole developmental time of the cycle, these guys seem to be following the additive line, and then they saturate. Okay? So again, we were discussing the parameters of the looping and looping seem to be changing as you move through the embryo in a way that in one part you have a regime that is subadditive, and in another part you have a regime that is subadditive. Okay? An alternative way to look at this is to ask, for each position, how does the sum of the two individual enhancers compare to the whole? Okay? So that's what I'm doing here. So this is the number of polymerases that I see in the case of the wild-type enhancer, the wild-type construct with the two enhancers. And here I sum the number of polymerases that I measure when I have only the primary plus the number of polymerases that I measure when I have only the secondary or the shadow enhancer. Okay? The line represents additivity. And what we see is that for this time point, hunchback goes between a regime of additivity, which would be consistent with weak enhancers not competing for each other, for the real estate of the promoter, and it also goes into a regime of subadditivity, where now you get less than the sum. Okay, and we found this to be true not only for hunchback but for other genes such as SNIL. So if you measure SNIL and you do the exact same thing that I showed you before, you're also going to see that SNIL is basically subadditive. So basically, the behaviors that we're seeing in SNIL and hunchback are consistent with the predictions from our model. And again, these predictions were qualitative predictions because we don't know what the parameters are yet. Cassandra.
You might have said this already, but how are the reporters made? Are they on bats, or are they replacing the adopted? So again, no shadow means you remove the adopted shadow, or do you make a construct using the
adopted? This is a reporter construct made on a back using a yellow reporter, and we replace the shadow by a sequence that is more or less the same length. So there are definitely a few caveats that could.
The endogenous shadow primary
are
there.
Are there, and they're far away. Yeah, and it would be great to. They're in different chromosomes. Even that, you're concerned about transfection? Who knows? Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Okay, okay.
But we have one control where we deleted both, and you don't see any activity.
On the reporter.
On the reporter. So at least that kind of rules out the transfection hypothesis. But yeah, I'm not saying this is an ideal thing, and you know, because when you delete things, maybe there are other sequences that repress and do other things, right? Exactly. Yeah. All right.
So,
yes?
This is super cool, but wasn't it eerie just how close the sum all of the larger lines, like almost exactly? Your no shadow line, the sum of the two together,
mm-hmm.
follows the no shadow line almost exactly always. So why?
This one?
Yeah, the black line and the green line are basically completely on top. So while I love
over here.
Line, yeah.
Yeah.
But all the time, throughout all your time points.
Well, yes.
So,
okay.
Have you tried making a point mutation in the proximal enhancer and seeing if, again, it just the black line exactly follows the green line? Maybe it turns the blue one off completely.
Yeah. So we have, you know, with hunchback, it's just that the issue is also that potentially we're hitting the speed limit. So this is actually another degree of saturation. But what you can do is you can do it in SNIL. Let me see. I have it here. Yeah. This is SNIL as a function of time now instead of space. And the black line, see how it's actually lower than the blue line? So we have examples where the black line is lower. Okay. I'm just not showing it for making things easier. Yes?
Describe the flattening off as reaching the speed limit.
Ah, sorry. I didn't want to. Yeah, so this has to be another degree of saturation, but this one could be saturation due to the speed limit.
Except that at the other times that you were showing, you still reach saturation at the same physical position, but at a much lower level. Right? The speed limit
yeah.
is
yeah.
polymerization.
Yeah. Well, but remember that here, basically, you're
that speed limit right there at the earlier time. Then.
Yeah, so. One subtlety here, though, is that as you see this movie progress, you're loading polymerases onto the gene. So for it to reach the saturation of the speed limit itself, it needs to go all the way to steady state.
But it goes down as well, right?
Well, I'm actually, no, I'm playing this in reverse. It does go down, but I'm playing it in reverse so that it's easy to see, because otherwise it's too. No. You do start seeing it go down, but it's just this for the purpose of what I wanted to show. I just looped it back and forth like that. Yeah. So no, I agree. You can't explain all of saturation with the speed limit. There are saturation. You know, there's only so much that transcription that each enhancer can give you, and that depends, I guess, on the combination of transcription factors and binding sites. That can bind to the enhancer, and binding sites that you have in the enhancer. Okay. So, what we did then is we look at knurps. Okay, so this was just another one to look at. And knurps, let me show you the wild type first. Knurps is expressed in a little domain here, and also has a little thingy there. And here, check it out, I had to do like all sorts of rotations this morning when I realized that I had assembled them the wrong way. All right, so now let's compare no shadow and no primary. So these guys kind of look the same. They look a little bit weaker, right? You see fewer spots. But the overall pattern qualitatively you would think is the same. Okay? So what we did is, again, same exercise. Grab one snapshot, plot the fluorescence of the wild type, the fluorescence of the no shadow, the fluorescence of the no primary, compare it to the sum of no shadow plus no primary. And this is what we saw. So now in this case, in NURBS, what we see is that the wild type is much larger than the sum. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. Okay? And remember, in Hunchback, we had a change of regime, right? When you came from the posterior, it was additive, and then it became subadditive. There's a change of regime also here in time. If I show you the same movie now as a function of time, note how in the beginning, Knurps is super additive, and then a little bit later in development, it becomes additive for the rest of development. Okay, so the molecular parameters are changing in time, and they're changing the nature of the cooperative, or, you know, of how these two enhancers are working together.
Is it known they're only
two enhancers in Knurps?
Yeah.
If you delete both, this is the one where we did the control. However, that doesn't rule out that you have some repressive element that is doing some funny business, because by deleting things, you can usually only screen for activators, right? So yeah, I think we need to do it much better. And basically, what we should do is a synthetic version where we have only those guys, and we know exactly what the background is. That will be the way to test this. Yeah. So yes, Jeff. With the actual Knurps promoter. Yeah, so that was a little bit what Cassandra had asked about transvection, in some sense. Yeah, it could be the case. Although, again, in this one, we deleted both enhancers and we didn't see any activity. Although we didn't do that control for all our bugs. Yeah, so that could be true. But, you know, we are putting them on different chromosomes. So, in principle, that should take care of some of the of the concerns. But, yeah, I agree. Transvection is a pretty interesting thing, and I don't understand. No. No, not at all. Not at all. But I mean, maybe that's what's going on here. So, but the point is that there's no way this model is going to give you super additivity. There's no way that if you assume that only one promoter can be engaged, one enhancer can be engaged to the promoter at a time, you're going to get super additivity. What you need to do is you need to invoke some other state where either the two enhancers are talking to the promoter at the same time, or where one is helping the other one loop, or something that has some synergistic effect. That has some synergistic effect on the process of looping or on the process of transcription. Yes?
Yeah, but maybe you need a state in front of that has to do with making the DNA accessible, just as an example, with respect to chromatin. Like, that's a step that strikes my mind.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think that could be, so the regulation of accessibility. So I think what Rob is implying is that maybe by transcription factors binding to this enhancer, they make this one more accessible because they like kick off nucleosomes and things like that. And then this one has an easier time being recruited. And now you have two enhancers that can activate. And I would think that you can project those effects onto these rates, onto some cooperativity in the rates of looping. But it would be great to do the calculation. You're not convinced? Okay. All right. So we should do the calculation. Yeah, Mike.
What do you know about the transcription factor? This was Knurps.
Yeah, Knurps.
Is it a dimer?
there's multiple transcription factors that are mediating this expression. So there's picoid, and it also has cross repression with other genes, just such as cripple.
I'm not talking about the term.
No. Sorry? Yeah. So So we didn't do an attempt to try to figure out. I mean, the regulatory regions here are, you know, we know some of the transcription factors, but they haven't really been mapped to the detail that, for example, the Hunchback enhancer has been mapped. So we know what the DNA sequences are, but we don't really know this is the binding site for this gene transcription factor or this one. Yeah. So we didn't go in that level of depth, which would be great.
But how far away is the proximal distal in the case of
KNURPS? KNURPS actually, you know, this is not the right picture because one enhancer is in the intron. That is a few, like 1 kb after the transcription initiation site, and the other enhancer is upstream. Yeah?
But it's totally believable that if you have one that doesn't even need to bend at all, and you have another one that can bend there.
Yeah, but that's the case for Hunchback, too. Hunchback, you have one enhancer right next to the promoter and one enhancer thousands of base pairs away. So, but again, it could be that in one case it does it, in one case it doesn't. Yeah, Jeff?
There is still marks associated with chromatin accessibility, like H3K4.
Yeah.
Have you tried to look for those marks at those enhancer sites?
My understanding is that those were the marks that they used to discover the shadow enhancers. Yes, that they do correlate with them being enhancers. And that's why they say, ooh, this looks like an enhancer. It's near this gene. Let's look at what it does. Yeah. All right. OK. So I'm on. Yes? That's a great question. Yeah, I don't know. It works. All I can tell you is that it works. We haven't looked at it in much detail. Yeah, I don't know if polymerase kicks things off and then they are able to bind right away. I mean, for sure, polymerase is a pretty strong molecular machine. So making a roadblock for polymerase is relatively hard, although you can put nucleus on a positioning sequence that make it really hard for polymerase. That basically induces pausing. But I'm not sure of examples of putting like a transcription factor that becomes a roadblock for polymerase. Maybe, but I would be curious about the mathematical implementation of the words that you just said. And I don't know if they would lead to the same quantitative picture. Yeah, I would love to think about it, but I don't know how to at this point.
There's a bit of a mistake to make with that. I mean, it's close to thinking, but the answer would have to be in a single model, which may well not be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be that it knocks things off the DNA as it's moving along, and then the guys rebind in the back. So I don't really know. The only thing I know is that it works. And you find a lot of enhancers in introns. Yeah. All right. Okay, so I'm almost done here. If we go back to this representation, remember we had SNAIL here and Hunchback, and they were both either additive or subadditive. And what we found is that there are other examples of these shadow enhancers that lead to superadditivity. And, you know, basically this superadditive regime where you have weak enhancers, right? And you can compare the relative magnitude to Hunchback, for example. Weak enhancers that actually lead to a much larger level of gene expression than the sum of its individual parts. Okay? Yes? I don't know how to extract the K-on and K-off because there's two, you know, there's K-on and K-off for each one, right? So there's K-on and K-off for each one of these, right? And there are these rates, you know, let's forget about it. You know, let's do this simple model, right? And these K-ons and K-offs are depending, for example, on the time and the position that you're in. So my claim is that these all get modulated by the regulatory landscape. And, you know, you would have to extract it in each case. And it would be fun to find a way to extract them. I think with a description of the mean, it's going to be really hard. But with a description of single cells, by looking at what each cell does, we might be able to use the fluctuations to map out what these parameters are. So that would be one of the things that would be interesting to do, and we're working towards that. But it requires a little more of technology development. All right. Okay. All right. So I'm basically done. I mean, so, you know, I started asking this question about why multiple enhancers, and I don't think I answered it in any way. But one of the things that we found is that for sure there is no one-size-fits-all for multiple enhancers, that they can switch between different regimes of activity, right? They can switch from subadditivity, where the whole is less than the sum of the parts, to additivity, where the whole is just the sum of the parts. And we saw that in Hunchback, where in one part of the pattern it was additive, in one part of the pattern it was subadditive. We saw that in Snell that it was subadditive. And you can also get into a regime where you have superadditivity, where the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And again, this is not fixed in time or space, because we saw in KNURPS how in the beginning of development you had superadditivity, but then it switched to additivity, and it was really dead on the sum for most of the time. For most of the time that the development went on. And so again, I don't think I have a good answer to the question of why does the fly need multiple enhancers. I mean, for example, why couldn't you just generate these patterns with only one enhancer? In principle, I didn't see any patterns that I would think, oh, I can't think of a way I would design an enhancer to make this pattern. Basically, if any of us was designing it, probably we would come up with some arrangement of binding sites for repressors and activators that could give you the same pattern. So why do you need multiple enhancers? And one of the hypotheses that people have been throwing around is that maybe the fact that we see no functional distinction or no advantage to having two enhancers comes from the fact that we're doing everything in the lab at very nice and cozy conditions, right? So people, for example, in the Levine and the Stern labs, they've been starting to do these experiments in conditions where you change the temperature to temperatures that are not as nice for the flies, or where you start inducing mutations, like you change gene dosage of genes in the network. And what seems to be the case is that decent flies that have the two enhancers do better than flies that have only one enhancer. Okay? But how do you come up with a quantitative picture of this, to me, is still an open question. But for sure, what I think is that... Well, so for example, in SNP, if you don't have the two enhancers, the percentage of embryos that make it all the way to adulthood is smaller. So there, you know, it's not just do you live or die, there's some randomness to it. Yeah. And then there are some measures, and these haven't been done in terms of measures of does the embryo live or die, but if you look at measures of noise in gene expression, for example, the claim is that the two enhancers reduce noise, make you more robust. But I'm not convinced again about how this would all work out if you now are curious about the numbers. Yes, what else did I want? Yeah, so the point to me, you know, obviously I started trying to frame this in the context of the program, and I think it's a very interesting question to ask, can these enhancers be the substrate for evolutionary novelty? But I think at this point we're still in the fact gathering stage, trying to figure out what's the cell biology of these enhancer-promoter interactions. How does an enhancer that is 100 base pairs from a promoter actually decide only to talk to an enhancer that is to a promoter that is 1,000 base pairs? Or how do multiple enhancers fight it out to control one promoter? Okay. People like Angela DePace have been looking at that, and I believe that in most cases they look very similar, although in one case, I think in Krupel, I think they found that the way the two shadow enhancers are working together is different from melanogaster. But I don't know the answer all the way to that. They for sure you can find these shadow enhancers in the different species, you know, closely related species within like 30 million years. I don't know the answer. You seem to have some thoughts about it. When did they appear? When did the shadow enhancers appear? Did you?
When evolutionarily?
Well, because I thought you said that there was an outgroup that didn't have that many shadow enhancers. Maybe I misunderstood you.
No, I think what I was trying to say was that looking at the evolution of multiple enhancers and of shadow enhancers, it's difficult to trace
Okay.
Raises interesting questions about what the evolution of this is, and certainly leads me to think that what you're probably looking at is a collection of many transcription-associated factors there who they interact through multiple loads of the interactions to give you this kind of robustness.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very difficult to go beyond genus level and see specific binding sites or specific factors that are observed in their binding, even though the patterns are certainly concerned.
I guess I don't know. I guess the answer is I don't know. But all I know is that you find multiple enhancers for genes in development all the way from flies to mammals. And there are many genes. There's not just two enhancers. You can have 20 or something. Boris. It is, yes.
But if you just think that the genes are expressed in different tissues, many people just think that enhancers, different enhancers derive expressions in different tissues, then sort of the great peculiarity of why is why it is addressing stripes that physicists might think should be generated by some periodic semitogenesis-like process labeled at once, but addressed differently, which doesn't seem to be a question you're asking. And then, of course, there is the whole biophysics aspect of interactions and cooperativity and looping and how it is that doesn't seem to matter much how far away the cancer is located, et cetera, et cetera. So, all the biophysical aspects that actually allow the same promoter to be happily addressed by multiple enhancers.
Yeah.
So, there's a whole bunch of things that are just kind of.
Yeah, so I guess. Well, here I think we're mostly tracking why multiple enhancers with overlapping activities, right? Because the first scenario that you described is of enhancers are active, each one is active in a different cell type, and that gives you the different stripes. But here these are enhancers are active in the same cell. And I guess we're addressing that, and we're also addressing the biophysical constraints on how multiple enhancers are active in the same cell. Yeah, in the with same cells within the same tissue. What do you mean?
Well, same tissue. So if you think of different stripes as different tissues, but one is the head and another one is the tail.
Yeah. So, but that's what I'm saying. We're not addressing that question at all because we've been focusing on enhancers that only are act that where both enhancers are active in the same tissue, in the same cell. What you're thinking about is, for example, there's enhancers that activate each one of the stripes, for example, of Eve, right? I mean, that's one scenario, but that's not what we're addressing now. That was known, and I'm not saying that we understand it either.
This is the why question, right? So by the time you have introduced, for some reason, perhaps because you wanted to address different stripes.
Ah, I see.
You can have them overlap, and
okay.
You know about duplication and redundancy and all that. I just don't see how you're going to answer the why question.
Yeah, no, and I'm not sure we'll ever answer it, but I still claim that it's one way to drive curiosity. And again, I'm just speculating on why, what are the advantages? I mean, it's, one thing that I learned in this program is that, not everything needs to give you an advantage for it to be there, right? I think I learned that lesson here. But at the same time, I think it's still interesting, especially in light of evidence that suggests that they do confer some advantage under some conditions that are not the best conditions for growth of the fly. So I agree. This is, I don't think you can ever answer this question necessarily, but you could ask, why would you want it if you were designing it? And I do think that's a useful intellectual exercise. Yeah. Mike.
This might be relevant, sort of related to Boris' question. So there's this idea of self-functionalization, splitting of genes. That would be called qualitative, but what seems to be coming out of gene duplication work, it's a kind of quantitative subfunctionalization.
same functions, but one goes up, the other goes down, some stays the same. And duplications in regulatory regions, because they're so small, they're more, much more common than gene duplications. So this could be going on with these different enhancers. So, you know, one is higher than the other, and the net effect is what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, useless. So neither one may be the optimal enhancer. So, you know, it'd be nice if you had a species that had just one enhancer.
Yes.
To what's going on with the two.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. And one of the things that we've been trying to do, and we try to do that also in the courses, to start looking at all the related species with the same technology. So we still need to get the transgenics up and running, but it would be great. I agree. Yes?
Completely absurd fantasy to imagine a in vitro transcription system that would allow you to actually see how overly simplified this model is.
People are trying to do that with cell extract. Actually, in the DePace lab, they're trying to do some single molecule assays looking at how Bicoid binds to an enhancer. They haven't gotten to the point.
You'd like to do it in a fully defined system where you're going to have, because there are undoubtedly many other factors that influence this.
Like yeah.
You can think of lots of ways those might act. They might be other competing factors that are not in themselves.
Yeah.
Suggesting earlier or more facilitate cooperativity in binding between these two sites or a million other things.
Yeah. No, I would say that both the in vitro and synthetic reconstitution in the in vivo setting of these effects would be great. And you know, the in vitro part, you know, it's a little bit outside of my expertise, but the in vivo synthetic reconstitution is something that we're trying to push. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is that actually enough to get the super additive behavior that you saw?
Yeah, because you can start. At that point, you have so many parameters that you can.
So you can.
Yeah, you can do it. Yeah. Yeah, but that's where I stop in terms of trying to be fancy with the model, because I got so many parameters that I don't know what to do with it. So I know it can give me the super additivity, but until I figure out some other way of constraining the model more, I'm just. Well, actually, here I said that the rates were the same, but you could have a little omega for comparativity here. But already with this, you could get it. For example, yeah. So that's what I'm saying. I just can't make up little factors to put everywhere. Yeah.
If you artificially duplicate one enhancer, you get the sum of the.
I don't know. That's part of the synthetic reconstitution of this process. Yes, I think that's clearly an experiment that needs to be done in a background of sequence that you know that is well defined. All right, so that's good. We finished early. That's great. No, this is not what I wanted to show you. Oh, man. Sorry. A second. Where do we go? Here. Okay, so just again, this work was all done together with Jack. Was now a postdoc in my lab. Back then, he was a grad student with Mike, and also, so this is a collaboration from my postdoctoral lab at Princeton, from Thomas Gregor's and Mike Levine's lab. And I also need to thank these guys here for funding, and you guys for your attention, and I'll be happy to keep discussing these ideas afterwards. Thank you very much. Yes, Jorge. Ah, okay. One second. Here.
So basically, what we chose already nailed shows that for productivity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So my question is that, you know, you show that, okay, you put this model, you can actually get that productivity, but you never really know what mediates that to productivity, and it also changes with time. You can not show that variance is there at any time. Right?
Yep.
So if you check if there's any relationship between that and the other regulators that are around, because once we see, one of the other regulators may be facilitating somehow to promote something to each other.
Yeah, so none of these guys are expressed at high levels in the middle of the domain of NURBS. Okay? So but there could be other regulators that are expressed uniformly in the embryo. But all of these guys basically the peaks of these different domains, they don't overlap. They kind of define the whole, they kind of fill the whole embryo. So I don't think it would be one of these, at least not in the core. But it could be some other factor that is not here. For example, this doesn't take into account uniform factors. And there's one, for example, that people, you know, we've been starting to look at called Zelda, which is, yeah, it's actually go after somebody played a lot of The Legend of Zelda, and they call it Zelda because of that. But basically, for example, this is a transcription factor that seems to facilitate initiation of transcription. And it's uniformly expressed. And it's maternally provided. And if you don't have it, you don't live. At least the flies. We don't have Zelda. We have something else. But yeah, so I agree. There are probably other factors. And those factors could be effectively modifying those K-on and K-offs and rates. Yeah. Dan?
Generally test the class of models you're going to have. So for example, the whole experiment way that you're looking at it, there's no history dependence and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not obvious that that's correct, right? And so one can certainly imagine that if you look at the data closely enough, you could test that irrespective of any particular mechanism.
Yeah, so you can do, so for example, you could start asking questions about this is a single molecule, this is a single cell trace, right? Fluorescence is a function of time, and you can start asking questions about these dynamics relate to the dynamics of the mother nuclei? And so far the answer is no, we haven't found one, although I think that Levine Lab found one case when you make things really weird, there seems to be some inheritance of the probability of transcription in SNIL. But yeah, this technology now allows us to ask those questions. It's just that every time, when we've looked at it, we haven't found a memory effect yet. But my feeling is that at some point, there's some other evidence that suggests that this can't just be reading out the instantaneous concentration of activators and repressors, that it needs to be integrating or doing something funky like that. Yeah. All right. No, it doesn't have to bind. And that's why when I was talking about engagement, I was always using the quotation marks, because I don't know we really don't know what the molecular picture is. We like to think of it in terms of looping, but the evidence for looping in the way of just a long strand of DNA getting closer to another part of the DNA, I think that the evidence for that is rather limited. And then absolutely, that could be one of the answers. Absolutely, yeah. So I think we need to do much better in order to reveal what's going on at the molecular level there. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.